This is a continuation, part two, of the December 15th, 2018 look at the Noahide laws. We have established the three entities of the first four centuries, and now we're going to go back in time, and we're going to look at things back in Genesis and then move forward to Qumran, and then we will get into the writings after that. Okay, so this is part two of part one, basically. So in the homework, what I sent out was the general understanding of what the seven Noahide laws are. I say general understanding because there's a whole lot of different versions of what the Noahide laws are. Some are seven, some are five. I found one that was 13. I found another one was 30. I found one that was 66. So we have a lot of variations, but the one that seemed to garnish the most votes was the seven. So we're going to use the seven, and we're going to take a look at Genesis. And this was the homework, and I will read it. I'm not going to read these because you can see what they are. But I am going to... she didn't put it. Nope, she just answered the question. Okay, well, here was what my homework assignment was. Since I was using this set of seven, as where we would begin looking at this, I wanted to, and because we know about Noah picks up around six. I don't know if he's mentioned in five, he might be, but he's at least in six. And I know he's clearly through nine, he's probably into ten, but at least nine, six through nine, at least. But because of the generous sort of person that I am, I said we could go ahead and start at Genesis chapter 1 and go through chapter 9. Did I say 2? Okay, I wasn't as generous as I thought. But anyway, chapter 2 to chapter 9, and I wanted you, your homework assignment was to read that text and tell me where each one of these comes from in the text. That was my assignment. So it was very simple. You're looking for where it says not to commit murder. There's a good example. So where does that take place? That takes place in chapter 9. Who's got the verse for that one?
Cain and Abel would be where...
There's no commandment about committing, not committing murder. I mean, he did commit murder. But you would think that there was a commandment because he was told that it was wrong to do that.
So you're not looking for inferences in there. You're looking for
the actual commandment. Yeah. But I'll take an inference.
Okay.
Where?
You shall not eat any. Oh, wait.
The Noahide laws are derived.
Yes, we'll get to that.
Okay, yeah, and that's why I'm talking about, Cain and Abel.
Yes, and you are correct. We're going to find out what's literally commanded, then we're going to find out what's derived. That way we can be fair to both ways of looking at the text. Have you found it yet?
I would say 9:6.
What does it say?
Whoever sheds man's blood by man, his blood shall be shed.
That sounds like to me a pretty straightforward instruction to not commit murder. All right, so we have found one. All right, is there anything about eating meat that hasn't been cooked?
Right.
Oh, we've got number two, which in the list is number seven, not to eat flesh torn from a living animal. A vegetarian
first.
Couldn't eat meat that was raw, could they?
Yeah, but it doesn't say don't eat. It could just be referring to an animal that is a living being.
I would go with living being.
This
and you're not supposed
nine,
to rip their arm out of the socket.
This is chapter 9.
And start chewing on it.
Well, that's what I used to think,
right?
But all I'm thinking that it's possible that you're not supposed to eat the animal.
You could eat you're not supposed to eat the arm or the rest of the animal.
You're not supposed to eat a part that you cut off of a living animal. That's what the commandment
is. Is that what it says?
But I'm saying it could also mean that you're not supposed to kill a living animal.
No, you could
eat it.
No, that's not what it says.
But it doesn't say that.
Saying that, nowhere near saying that.
But it doesn't say otherwise either.
What does it say? It says it early. What does it say in 9:3?
every moving thing that lives shall be food for you.
Okay, what does that mean?
Yeah, but you and I both know that every moving thing is not food for us.
That is true. Well, so it must be a subset of something that's already been instructed.
Again, it goes back to the original audience understood what food meant. The original audience were the people at Sinai.
Yeah.
This story is being told to them. It's not a running narrative. So they understood what food was. So when the story is told that every living thing that moves is food, they know what food is, so they move forward with that. It's been misinterpreted into, oh, now I can eat pig.
Well, some people have said that. I've seen that.
Right.
Okay. But anyway, that's outside the scope of this. What's that?
I said, and I have an idea on that idea.
Okay.
What food is.
We don't want to go there, but I appreciate it. It's outside the scope of this discussion.
That's not what I meant.
Okay, what?
What I'm saying is that if all living things were food for them in Noah's time, then the commandment in Moses' day would be a further separation.
That's a good point.
From that. Okay, because we are supposed to be set apart.
Right. That's a good point. It is important to note that in chapter 7, Noah knew clean and unclean. That's clear. So if he knew clean and unclean, then he would know in chapter 9, clean and unclean. And it would be reasonable if he asked God, okay, now tell me about this clean, unclean thing. What does that mean? It's possible that God said, well, you can eat of the clean, but you can't eat of the unclean.
Well, when we go and we say, well, you know, he knew Torah, which is what we're talking about, saying clean and unclean, we're assuming that nowhere else on earth did anyone have a sense of clean and unclean animals in whatever their regard they had when they sacrificed to their gods. I think that we can't assume that that clean, particular clean and unclean necessarily relates to Torah. And for us to say that Torah is of that time.
I agree.
I think there are laws that everyone understood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the Noahide.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
okay. It's the same Hebrew word.
Well, then
Torah is given in Hebrew. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then that interpretation means that Noah could possibly have only brought two of what later became what is now clean, and the propensity. Whereas, you see where I'm going with this. If there was only two of, let's say, the cow, instead of seven pairs, there was only one pair, then the likelihood of that making it through the process is less likely.
Yeah, I think we can safely say that the Torah, the idea of bringing the seven pairs of clean animals was because they knew what sacrificing was and that there were certain animals that they could sacrifice.
Okay.
We can't assume that those people at Sinai operated in a Torahic vacuum, and that's because they knew all about the worlds around them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm saying, that they knew. I haven't looked that hard, but I'm sure that we can see that there's something out there we can find clean and unclean. Insofar as
may I say something?
He's still talking. No.
And insofar as the limb from a living animal, that's a don't do what the other people do. Don't
right.
do that because that's how they existed.
Right.
And eating meat, they would cut off part of an animal, eat it, and they keep the rest of alive by the fact that the animal was alive for as long as the animal could stand.
Okay, do you see how far out the scope, outside of the scope of this discussion about the Noahide laws and their application to Gentiles, the discussion of clean and unclean food is way outside the scope, though, you see.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Beth, go ahead.
If this text is written so that those who came afterward, you know, are to read it and to understand it, when it's written in Genesis that Noah took so many clean and so many unclean, that means that the people that were Mosaic Law and later or whatever, when they read the text and they see, or, you know, it's read to them or whatever, and they hear that Moses took so many clean and so many unclean, they would have to assume that Noah knew exactly what clean was and unclean was, and it would be the same as what they defined it as, whereas what God defined it as. We cannot say that the animals in Noah's day, the unclean ones were different from the unclean ones in Moses' time. I mean, that seems somewhat illogical that would be happening.
Is that the point? You're not making that point,
no,
are you, Dennis?
I didn't make that point.
Okay.
I think it's interesting what it was at Sinai. Because at Sinai, you know, the idea of clean and unclean was codified. Then they could look back maybe in the Genesis account and say, see, even going back there, you know, there was some sense of clean and unclean.
Mm-hmm. I think that's possible.
I think that's okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Beth. All right, let's continue. We found two, right? We found two of the seven. Okay, did anybody find not to worship idols? Nope. Okay, did anybody find that we are not to curse God? Okay. Did we find any place where it's said to establish courts of justice? Because I have an idea about that, but Dennis, you go first.
On the curse.
Oh, on the curse?
There is commentary around, you know, when it said they began to call on the name of God.
Yes.
Right? That is not the pleasant thing that we think. But calling on the name of God is the blasphemy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not like...
Say louder.
Okay. He was saying that earlier in the Genesis text, when it says they began to call the name, might be cursing God.
Yeah. This is, you know, again, from the analysis of the rabbis and all of that.
Right. Okay, and I'm glad you're bringing that up, too, because I'm going to make a point about it in a second. But let's go to established courts of justice. Here's a thought. I think maybe we'll go with Juliet's derive from comment, because this might be a derive from. Can you go back to the text in Genesis 9, probably within 5 or 6, where it's talking about murder?
Okay.
Okay, read that text.
Hand of man, from the hand of every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed.
Okay, let's stop right there. Read that section again, just that section.
Whoever sheds man's blood.
So whoever murders somebody,
by man his blood shall be shed.
Will be put with the punishment will be death. But it's going to be man that's going to see to the punishment.
Right.
Isn't that a judicial system derivative of that statement?
Yes.
Okay, I have one vote. Any other votes?
Yeah.
Dennis has got a half a vote, okay?
Yeah.
You said could be.
Yeah.
She said yes. Okay. Establishing courts of justice is a huge endeavor, and this is a single commandment, but it just seems like to me God is saying that you people, if this happens, you need to handle it. And the way you need to handle it is you need to take that person's life. That's what it seems to be saying to me. So I see a possibility that we could derive that we need to have a way to be able to judge if somebody was guilty of taking a life so that we could take their life.
Can we go to verse 4:10 as well?
10:4?
4:10. Starting with God's dialogue with Cain after he kills Abel. I was
about to say that.
Okay, Mike.
So what we have happening here, then he said, what have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to you from the ground. So now you are cursed from the ground. You open his mouth and receive the blood. You have spilled and you have shed. If you work the land, which you will never again, you will be a restless wanderer of the earth. But Cain answered the Lord, my punishment is too great to bear. Since you are banishing me today from the soil, I must hide myself in your presence and become a restless wanderer of the earth. Whoever finds me will kill me. That's the beginning part of, I think, and this is what happens, is the Lord replied and said, in that case, whoever kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over, and he placed a mark on Cain so that whoever found him would not kill him. Then Cain went out of the Lord's presence and lived in the land not used to him.
Well, then how come he got away with murder?
What I'm not saying is that he did, actually, but he could have went out and potentially been punished by others who would have known that he had done that. I don't know that he's fearing, in this particular case, going to the land and being killed because he's different or because somebody, how they know. And I think that God marks him for a reason, which is to have them know, you're not, don't kill me. I don't know why, but yeah, potentially out there, there has been established a system of justice somewhere that knows it.
I see what you're saying. Yes.
That's
yes. Dennis?
Life in prison, kind of. He's in a certain kind of prison in the land of Nod. You know, that marking marks him as being.
Yeah.
And
that,
although this is not the same, this is not the same,
yeah.
Said, but it's very similar to what we see later in cities of refuge that are established. Cain's murder is not a situation in which he accidentally murdered someone and is now sent to a city of refuge, but
true.
He was sent somewhere else as punishment, but will be killed there. He's not supposed to, for whatever reason.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. That's why we have to look at this and say this is certainly not capital punishment. As we would know it as life for a life, which is taught later.
Which is taught later.
That's why I'm not sure, but it's just
okay, very good. Thank you, Kevin. Juliet?
In like people who talk about evolution all the time, they say that if somebody's cut off from their tribe,
yeah,
it's death.
Oh. Because they're separated from the community.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Beth, did you have something?
No.
Okay. All right, so what have we got? We got the not to eat flesh torn from a living animal, that's one. Not to commit murder is two. And to establish courts of justice is three. So out of the seven that have been recommended, we have found three. Curse God, Dennis brought up chapter 4, so that's something we have to look into. Is there anything in there about not committing adultery or sexual immorality? The reason I ask that is because there was an event that took place with Noah and one of his sons. And when the event took place, whatever the event was, Noah got mad at his son. Now, did he curse the grandson? You didn't see what?
The torn flesh. That was 9:4.
9:4.
I don't think that's what it said, but I'll
look. Okay. So back to the event with Noah and his son. And the cursing of the grandson. Could we extrapolate that that is one of many things that could be discussed, but that is one of many things that would fall under the instruction here not to commit adultery or sexual immorality?
Well, given that your homework assignment said 2 through 9, that falls out of the scope of where you told us to look.
It does?
It does.
When did the thing happen? 10?
Oh, I'm sorry, you were right. It is in 9.
I thought it was in 9. Okay.
It is.
Dennis?
Never mind.
You're okay.
9.4.
9, okay.
That sexual immorality, I mean, it is vivid and absolute. If you look at present 8, where the Son of God came down and had relations.
Oh, 6.
Six.
Yes. Six. Yeah, but that's, you know, that's got an asterisk by it.
What do you mean?
I mean that these were not humans. B'nai Elohim.
It's a teaching lesson.
Okay.
It's a teaching lesson.
But it says they took him as wise. Why isn't that allowed?
Why would God destroy the earth because of all that was going on? They were doing something that's definitely wrong.
But it wasn't marrying the women.
Well, it may.
I think it's more of a.
There were some secret stuff going on. Yeah. Okay. All right. So maybe we're getting close to that one. All right. How about this one? Not to steal. Is that anywhere? Anybody find anything about stealing? Dennis?
This is just work that I've done at my home. I haven't seen a homework yet. But yeah, stealing is the apple. You're stealing from God. God is saying, do not touch us, do not use us.
You know, I think you got something.
I think that's
a stretch. That's a stretch? Okay. Yeah. We have one vote that's a stretch.
Yeah.
No, one stretch.
What did she say?
What, Beth?
I said that is quite a big stretch.
I would say this. I mean, this is not me, all right? Believe me, I'm not smart enough. I'm not. I just worked at some of this stuff, and I've seen what some of the rabbis have come at. And this is part of where they think it's derived from.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you got to give them some credit.
I am. I'm going to talk about them right now.
Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
I cannot give them credit because I have read this stuff and I go back to the text and they are way out of line, way beyond what anybody can naturally infer from the text. They are so far beyond what they say, that I cannot give them credit for it. I just cannot.
Okay, Beth has taken an opposing position. Okay. All right. Let me join in the fray because we're far enough along now that I think we have something established. What in the world? That looks like a clone. I like it. Okay. Dennis has mentioned this several times. But let's go back to what I said in the first part of this first part. We really have two entities. We have the Yeshuic Judaism sect that continued all the way up to the 5th century and beyond, but we're only talking about the first 5 centuries. And then we have the rabbinic sect that gathered everybody in because the Karaites didn't break off until the 6th century. So within the window that I'm talking about, we got two Jewish groups. We've got the rabbis and their writings. We have the Yeshua group and their writings. So if we're going to look at the Noahide laws, then there's only two groups that can write about them, because there's only two groups that have writings, the Yeshua group and the rabbinic group. So each one of them takes a position on this, and that's where we can learn from that. Now, follow along, okay? From the beginning of the Sinai revelation, there has always been the issue about a stranger in the land, a stranger who sojourns with you, and etc. And throughout the history of Israel, there has been that question of how do we deal with Gentiles in the land? So we've got historical documents called the Tanakh. They go all the way up to around 400 BC. That's plus or minus, but that's kind of where they close out. And so we have all of that information there that we can look at. And there have been situations, and Nehemiah 10 is a good example, where they had to deal with people who were not Israelites, who were co-mingling with Israelites. And it caused problems. That was just one example. So dealing with people who were not part of the Commonwealth of Israel has always been an issue. And then we get to the first century, and then we have some serious issues. All right, so one of the things that Dennis just brought up is that the rabbis which is the rabbinic Judaism sect, beginning in the late 2nd century into the 3rd century A.D., issued their first writings on the Noahide laws. I have those quotes, okay? And I've already read them. And this is where the discussion first takes place, is like, well, let's be generous and go 175 to 250 A.D. is where it first shows up.
Is that the Mishnah?
No. It's the one before that. I have it here somewhere. I'll try to get it for you. Okay? Tosefta, that's what it is. Tosefta is the first writing. This is the first time that we see it in that sect's writings. And what is the point that they're trying to deal with? So you're going to have to kind of bear with me a minute as I make my case. If there is a problem with Gentiles who are in the land, then what? How are you going to solve it? So there's two sects that are going to try to solve this. The rabbinic sect says the Noahide commandments, and they created that. They did the derivation, as we have talked about, that you and I have both read, based on the Genesis text, I think it's 2:15, where they derived all seven of these from Hebrew usage, which, and Beth has looked at it too. That shows up in the 2nd, 3rd century A.D. It's interesting that there's one other sect of writings that we can talk about, and that sect is called the Yeshuic Judaism sect. And they have writings that address the same problem of what to do with the Gentiles who want to come in and be with the Commonwealth of Israel. So we got two sets of writings. So depending on which sect you want to go with, you can go with this sect and how they say to solve it, or you can go with this sect and see how they solve it. So if you were to look at those two, which we will get to in part two, not this part two, this is part two of part one. When we get to part two, we'll sort that out, and I'll present that. But in reality, what are we talking about? All the other sects either don't exist or don't have writings, so there's only two sects left. And what did they write about how to deal with Gentiles who want to come in and be in within that boundary of the Commonwealth of Israel? And so that's what we need to cover. But we understand and are in agreement that you have the Tosefta and then the what is it called there, Dennis?
The Mishnah.
The Mishnah. And then eventually we got Babylonian Talmud a few centuries later, and then we got Maimonides and a few centuries later, and they all have been writing on this stuff about how they see it and how this should be handled. So we're going to have to look at that eventually, not today, because that would fall into detail. But what I'm setting up for you is that we would like to think those people who subscribe to rabbinic Judaism would like to think that from the beginning this has been the understanding, even though there's no evidence for it. So then in a recent archaeological discovery within the last 100 years that we'll go with, they found something that they thought would give credence to the rabbinic position. And it's from the Book of Jubilees. How many people are familiar with that book? It's not a rabbinic writing. It is a Qumranite writing. And in chapter 7, verse 20, which I'm going to read for you now, you're going to see what they have. One second, let me find it. Okay, here we go. I think. Nope, that's not it.
You said verse 20.
Verse 20. Okay, read me the first part of it.
What chapter was that?
7. Yes, that's where I start. Noah began to enjoin. That's the quote. Now I'm seeing if I can find it here. But if you have it, you can go ahead and read it.
I could not hear.
It's chapter 7 and verse 20. And the part of the quote that I'm starting is where it says, Noah began to enjoin his sons.
Upon
Okay, that's the quote. I thought I had it here. I am shocked that I don't. But anyway, thank you for finding that. All right, within that statement, it's saying Noah began to teach his sons some stuff. That's the overview, right? At some point in time, Noah began to teach his sons stuff. Then there's a short list. How many is it there? Half a dozen? Approximately half a dozen. If you look at the list of what is there, what you will find is that there is really no relation between that and the seven that Rabbinic Judaism lays out. So this is what I referred to previously as a historic source. If you want to use something that's before the first century, then you do have something from Qumran. If you want to use something after the first century, there is no Qumran, because they don't exist. But this is before, because this was written during that time up to the first century. So we do have this piece of evidence, which I have seen some of the Rabbinic Judaism people look to Hebraic scholars, and they'll say, well, here's an example of the Noahide laws in place right here. But in fact, it's not that at all. It was a stretch to try to make a connection prior to the Tosefta, which didn't work. And so other scholars have come after that, and this is the part I do have in my notes. When they did, here's what tends to happen. When you get an archaeological document, people go through it really quickly and pull out the pieces that ring the bell. And then they build something on it and publish a journal article. That seems to be the way it works. And then 10, 20, 30 years later, 50 years later, somebody comes along and says, you know, I think I'm going to look at this document within the context of what's going on and see what it says. So other Jewish scholars have done exactly that, and here's what they found. The plan of the Jubilees was to show that the entire Torah was known by the patriarchs, and even earlier by Noah and his sons, as oral tradition before its public revelation at Mount Sinai. That was a summation statement by a scholar who studied Jubilees within the context of the time frame of what was happening, and they were trying to use that to make the case of what Dennis was just disagreeing with, that we don't know that they had the whole Torah as oral revelation during the time of Noah.
Don't forget the writer of Jubilees. Where did he get that from? You know, this was written in 200...
Yeah, where did he get that from?
Probably,
or did he make it up?
Well, yeah, I don't.
Yeah.
Probably handed down traditionally, you know.
Possibly.
Word of mouth.
Right.
Which is how all this stuff gets to us.
Exactly. So he wrote something at that time point.
Right.
Okay.
So now, again, my argument would be necessarily to say that they knew all of that.
And I totally agree with you.
Now we got the scholar who's saying, oh, yeah, it did. Well.
No, he's saying it didn't. He's saying they were trying to make the case that they did, but
the
Rabbinic Judaism attempting to use Jubilees to make the case that the patriarchs all knew the whole Torah.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And you disagree with that.
I know, and I've heard the rabbis talk about this.
Okay.
You got to understand something. In Judaism, and in Catholicism and Messianism and all that, everybody is trying to make a case for themselves.
Yep.
They're all trying to make a case.
That's exactly right.
And so they take things, it doesn't matter, let's bend it a certain way. I mean, you know, I'm trying to find truth, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I find myself always arguing on the other side. You know, here, certainly, you know.
It has to be looked at that way.
But the rabbis, they've got so many things that are inherently wrong in my eyes.
Yeah.
They're trying to do. They don't want to talk about the Jews as being apostates and things like that. So even the Harvey Weinsteins of the world are all going to make it into heaven, right? Because of the reincarnation.
Yeah.
So you know, everybody's going to make it into heaven.
Yep. That's the best way to have it. Okay, let me give you my last point here. My last point was the position that if, this is a question kind of, if the Noahide laws in fact had been understood in existence, in other words, they had been understood from the time of Noah up to this point, prior to the first century, if that was pre-established and everybody recognized it and saw it, it would seem to me that we would find a historical event that would present itself as evidence that this is they did this, this is what they did. But in fact, that's not the case. All right, and I'm going to tell you the time is the Maccabean Revolt. And if you remember, the gentleman's name is John Hyrcanus. Is that close, Hyrcanus? Okay. So here's the information. There was a study of the time period, and they were trying to make the case concerning Noah, and everybody knew the commandments, as I said. Okay. But then moving forward, they were looking at what happened in the Maccabean era. And what happened there is that Israel took control of the land again and had their leader in place. But a whole bunch of the population were non-Jews. So if there was ever a time close to the first century in which we would see the employment of the Noahide laws, in other words, if it had been clearly understood for a millennium, we should see application. Because here they are taking back what had been taken from them to reset up the way things needed to be. So what happened? That is not what happened. And to make the case even more sound, as you know, the rabbis, they have a strong leaning toward tradition. The Sadducees, they hate oral tradition. Well, who was in charge after the Maccabean debacle, if you want to call it that? This particular gentleman who was part of the Sadducees. So if there was ever a clear understanding of the text, this would be the time and this would be the man. But here's what happened. Okay, here's the statement. Sadducees only accept the scriptures or authoritative, which we've already seen. So what does the record of what took place regarding Gentiles at that time in that location, 2 centuries before the first century? What took place? This is what took place. All the people who were not Jews were forced to convert to full Torah observance and forced to go through circumcision. Nobody was allowed to do Noahide laws. My question would be, if that was the understood practice for a full millennia, what happened? That's my historical question, and that's where we're ending today. So you can contemplate it. I'll send you the information, and we will pick up this part two on the first Saturday of January when we continue. Juliet, final question.
It's a comment. Just because the majority is doing something doesn't mean it's right.
That is always true. We have seen that before. All right. Beth, thank you for being a part. Everybody, thank you so much.
Yes, for-
Okay.
Is it written in the Maccabees about the Gentiles being forced to convert and observe the law?
Yep.
Yes.
Is it in first or second?
I have to look the quote up. It's in a footnote. I didn't write it down, but I can send it to you.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. All right, everybody, thank you. We'll have praise and worship in about 10, 15 minutes. Are we not? Yes, we are. We're not. We're taking a break.
Are we doing the Sukkot review?
Yeah, after we have praise and worship. Aren't we? No. Oh, okay.
You're doing a what review?
We're doing the Feast of Tabernacles review. We'll do one of the two of them next. All right?
We'll debate.
We'll debate. There you go.